Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. Welcome back to the show, Danielle, and happy Thanksgiving to our American listeners.
Yes, indeed.
Danielle, the Bank of Canada says for the first time ever, it's going to lose money. Their assets peaked at $575 billion March last year. They're now down to $415 billion, a loss of 28%. Should Canadians be worried?
Well, there's a few factors there. It's a reflection of the fact that some of the bonds on the balance sheet have declined in value. It's also a fact that they have been not renewing. They've been running assets down off their balance sheet, the so-called quantitative tapering that all the major central banks have been doing over the past year. The U.S. Fed is leading the charge on that, and they're basically trying to combat inflation not only by the most aggressive hiking cycle in terms of rates since the 1970s, but also through this additional factor of running down assets on the balance sheet. So ultimately, the central bank has this scenario where the bonds they're holding on the balance sheet are at a lower yield, because they were issued in a prior during the ultra low rate period. And whenever governments go to borrow money in this environment, of course, just like a mortgage holder who is, you know, looking to renew or their mortgage comes up for at the end of their term, they're facing a much higher interest rate environment. So the interest income from those prior issued instruments is low, and the cost of capital, the borrowing of new money, is much higher. So there's a bunch of factors at work here, but essentially, you know, we've lived, as I've talked about so many times, through this period of, certainly since the great financial crisis of 2008, when they continually prodded the world economy and borrowers into continuing to consume and borrow more money by loosening financial conditions relentlessly. And they did that for a short-term benefit of trying to manufacture growth and keep an expansion going in the global economy, but they did so at the long-term expense of stability and affordability and all the other things that are now coming back to haunt. Most of all, they encouraged this mindset in people to take greater and greater amounts of risk, even when that type of risk was not prudent or appropriate or likely to work out. And they really engendered a gambling preoccupation, which has been an incredible waste of resources, things that could have been done with capital much more productively than a bunch of financial gimmicks that have been undertaken as a main preoccupation. So we've really got this toxic soup now of, you know, asset prices falling, central banks inclined to let them fall for the first time in many decades, where the cover of inflation, the fact that we have the highest inflation, even though it's a backward looking, and even though inflation seems to have peaked in about June and the trend is coming down, you know, the actual reported rates are still high relative to what we've seen over the last 20 years. And so because of that, they have the cover to continue to tighten monetary conditions for the first time in many decades. So all along, this is really this brave new world where for so long people would take on imprudent amounts of debt, do imprudent things in terms of risk-taking and leverage, and they were bailed out repeatedly by central banks rushing to the rescue, propping up asset prices again and making rates come down. That's not happening now, and that's not happening probably for, you know, potentially another until potentially the middle of next year, where they maybe will look at trying to cut rates again, depending on the extent of the global downturn and how much, you know, asset disasters hit. And certainly we're seeing that across all major asset classes. Like, just as everything went up during the period of the great, you know, the great financial liquidity that was spewed from every port, now those same things are all, you know, unwinding. And now we have the most extreme monetary contraction. The U.S. M2 money supply, the seven-month rate of change, is a negative over the last, since they began hiking in March of this year. And it's the most negative we've seen since at least the 1950s. So it's not just that they've done this three times faster than normal hiking cycle, but they've also, as I said, been doing this quantitative tapering. So that's the Canadian Bank, the Bank of Canada has been doing it, and the U.S. Fed, which is allowing, you know, assets, bonds to come due and just not reinvesting the funds. And all of that is extracting liquidity from the global economy and financial system. And, you know, again, for the first time ever, you've got central banks around the world, including the U.S. Fed, who has intimated they understand that base case next year is a recession. But the Bank of Canada has also said that this week. The deputy governor was out, you know, doing a speech and saying they admitted that a recession and lower home prices are necessary if we're going to get inflation back below, you know, back into the target zone. The New Zealand Central Bank said the same thing. They have, you know, Canada has the world-leading asset bubble in terms of housing, an insane appreciation. The actual numbers are that over the past 25 years, Canadian housing, when you do the math, has increased by an average of 21% per year for 25 years. That makes us the world-leading housing bubble. And right behind it is New Zealand and Australia, who also have had not as bad, but similarly ridiculous appreciation in housing prices. Now, the problem is, of course, that's the most significant asset on household balance sheets. More than half of reported household equity comes from notional equity in their homes. So when you get a major decline in home prices, that hits the balance sheet of the most possible people in the economy and the middle class and all of the people that, you know, the economy depends upon as consumption units. So all of these things together have really set us up for this very difficult period here as things start blowing up left and right.
Pensions in deficit, is that a concern?
Yeah, well, this is part and parcel, right? So again, and I've spoke of this many times, but in, you know, the 1950s and 60s, when pensions were, you know, really being set up and funded, they were in a period of relatively more normal interest rates, positive sloping yield curves, where, you know, pensions were seen as this pool of money that had to be risk averse, right? It needed to be pairing its obligations, its promises to pay out to the recipients with its liability, with its assets. So the liabilities is the obligation to pay out, and the assets are the things that they put the cash in to make sure that it comes due at certain times and yields a certain rate of return so that you can predict with certainty that you'll have the funds required to be paid out. So what happened, of course, in the past 20 years, as regular interest rates were suppressed and all these gimmicks, you know, in the securitization of debt and all sorts of financial stuff that Wall Street and company came up with as genius ways to boost returns, so to speak, as interest rates came down, the urge or the migration of assets has gone away from things like government bonds and the most secure credits, which were guaranteed to return principal on a certain date and pay a certain amount of interest every 6 months. Those instruments have been very much pushed out in the portfolio allocations in favor of these really esoteric private equity, you know, levered loans, all sorts of sketchy stuff, which junk bonds, you know, this sort of thing. That's become a greater and greater proportion of pension assets. And the big problem there, of course, is those things are not marked to market. They're not like a boring old bond or stock that basically is traded day to day, and you have some idea of what the market value of that actual thing is on a given day. When it comes to these other pools, they are, quote, private assets. So they're not typically priced on a daily basis. And so the problem is that a whole bunch of conflicts of interest have developed where, you know, we've gone more and more as safe returns became harder to get. Instead of looking at how can we revitalize the pension plan in terms of putting in more savings, this goes for intent for retirement plans of individuals as well. You know, as rates came down, instead of having frank, honest conversations about in this environment, since you can't afford to lose money, what you really need to do is keep your risk as reasonably low as possible and increase your savings. Spend less in order to save more and possibly look at thinking about retiring at a later date. Of course, people don't love that sort of, they're not crazy about that sort of unvarnished truth. And so they looked more and more to magicians who could tell them that, oh no, don't worry, you'll be able to retire, you know, at this date, and you'll be able to take out 6 or 7% a year out of your portfolio. And this has been the, you know, target rate of return for many of these pensions has been in excess of 7%, even though rates have come off as much as they have. And so the way that they've done this, as I say, is to migrate more money into these very sort of dark pools, things that are not very transparent. And in so doing, the managers have structured their bonuses and their compensation for, you know, these fantastical, as if they're actually hitting these return targets, as if that's money good in the bank, when in fact it's not. And they've peddled that all over the free world, which is extremely lucrative for the managers themselves, but actually dishonest in the end, because it's not really serving the fiduciary duty and requirements of the pension plans to things like the recipients and to things like taxpayers, who are ultimately, you know, for many of these public plans, are on the hook to make up deficits. So right now, we've got, you know, a bunch of pension plans still haven't reflected the declines that have happened in asset markets year to date. In a large portion, up 25 and 30 and 40% of their assets have not yet been marked down to reflect what's been happening in the actual world this year. And ultimately, they will, you know, have to do that. They will have to disclose. And then we're going to understand that the holes, the deficits, are that much bigger than currently appreciated.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, the collapse of FTX, Bitcoin, and NFTs, should all these celebrities who promoted those products be held liable?
Well, unfortunately, paid spokespeople don't have a fiduciary duty. So this is you know, horrendous problem we have in the financial sector, where the people that bear the liability for giving correct and responsible advice are a tiny fraction of those who work in the space. And in many cases, like I've commented in the past, the crypto, you know, NFT space is largely unregulated. And it's ironic that the guy that was running FTX was actually one of the main political lobbyists, you know, giving funds to the politicians and telling them why they shouldn't be regulating his sector and why they should be left to their own devices. Of course, when you see this spectacular blow up and bankruptcy filing of that exchange, which was the second largest crypto exchange trading platform, Right away, everyone wants to know why there wasn't regulation in place. Of course, while things were going up, everyone was overly confident and cocky about, you know, why that was happening. In fact, it was a massive Ponzi scheme, and there was all these people on the payroll, like a Kevin O'Leary and, you know, the football guy and his wife and all that. Everyone's getting paid to promote this, and the whole purpose of that promotion is to suck in the little guy, right, to suck in the average person who has zero understanding of the risk typically that is being presented. They're impacted by these influencers to think, well, if they say it's good, it must be good. And meanwhile, the conflicts of interest, back to that whole mess that we have, the cesspool of what is advice and what is salesmanship. So ultimately, they are not required to give, again, any kind of advice or concern with regard to the losses that could impact people if they follow them. So it is a buyer beware scenario, and I've said this before, people are very hard to help in many cases because they want to believe the false prophets. They want to believe that they can get something for nothing or that they can, you know, make, get rich quick schemes. But in fact, what they ultimately end up finding is these are really get poor quick schemes. And that's what's happening right now. Now, the thing is, I think, as I've said, that we're in a brave new world here where we've had these implosions over the past few years, various things blow up, the odd player goes bankrupt, and ultimately the central bank steps in and provides liquidity. You know, even in the meltdown of March 2020, the U.S. Fed stepped in and saved the junk bond market by, you know, backing and saying they didn't have to be considered junk if they fell below a certain credit quality. So that was this really extraordinary thing. They allowed, you know, the buying of corporate debt during quantitative easing in past cycles as well as a way of backstopping. So we've really not had a good old-fashioned clearing bankruptcy cycle, credit cycle that resolves itself through the implosion of weak players. We haven't had that in a couple of decades, and it really shows. That's why we have so much junk in the system, why we have so many weak players that were only surviving based on, levering on levering and getting more free, cheap credit. Of course, now you've got, again, the central banks coming out and speaking very strongly about, you know, warning that, for example, in Canada, a fifth of the mortgages taken out in Canada, presently held by homeowners, were done so at, seem to have been taken out at the very ultra low in rates, around 1.5%. And now as they're coming up for renewal, those rates are in excess of 5%. So this is like a slow moving train wreck in the sense that, you know, it's not going to be evident immediately overnight. This is why when they start into these hiking cycles, we say it takes several months to quarters for it to actually move through the financial system. And that's why the economy is now slowing and heading into a recession in 2023. And central banks, you know, are still wanting to keep the pressure on, so to speak. I think because Jay Powell, again, the head of the U.S. Fed, is basically wanting to restore this room, this lever of rate room, that the central banks have been without for the past couple of decades. As they got nearer and nearer the zero bound, they lost their big stick, their leverage, their ability to, you know, have throttle open and shut on the economy in terms of controlling the amount of spending that was going on. And they resorted to quantitative easing as this sort of gimmick they could do because they were at the lower bound. Well, I think as this inflation has given them cover, they've now said, let's restore this room between us and the zero bound. Let's squash the animal spirits once and for all, because it was absolutely bonkers last year. I think it's ironic that it's the U.S. Thanksgiving this week in America, of course, And a year ago was the sort of the height of the madness, right, in terms of cryptocurrencies and all the stuff that was going on, people throwing money at crazy things. And, of course, that's all really imploded to an enormous degree over the past 12 months. Now, I think one thing that we should keep in mind is this is all necessary and helpful in the long run. And you know, things like housing, it is true when the U.S., when the Canadian Central Bank says that we must have lower prices, that that is part of the solution to restoring sustainability in the Canadian household and in the economy. That is for sure. And, you know, just looking at an example of the average purchase price in the Greater Toronto Area, say, back in February of 22 at the peak, was in excess of $1.1 million. So even if you had a fixed rate mortgage at that point of 2.99%, you know, your payment monthly was about $4,100. And at the end of 5 years, you'd still be owing $750,000 on your housing. Well, flash forward to the current average purchase price is around $800,000. That same sort of category has come down by about $300,000 already. Not only is the down payment you need significantly less, but even at a fixed 5-year rate of 5.59%, your mortgage payment is roughly the same. But here's the really important part. You'll be left owing about $585,000 at the end of 5 years, compared to $750,000. So this is the principal portion is what's coming down here. So even at higher rates, we're going to be in a much better scenario. Savers are getting compensated again. We're getting interest on our bank deposits again. We're getting, you know, pensions are now being attracted finally back to these, you know, more secure assets. The highest quality bonds are yielding more than 4%, up to 5% range. So this is the upside of all this, is that we're getting finally some compensation in favor of savers over speculators. And I think that over the next, you know, year, we're going to see more of that. And that the people that are barely holding on right now, who took on way too much risk, you know, the things that haven't been written down yet are not bouncing back quickly this time. They will ultimately have to be written down in value. Deficits will be revealed. Weak players will be taken out on stretchers. Asset bubbles will be burst. But in the end, we all benefit. In the end, we will get a much more sustainable, intelligent economic system and compensation for savings and risk. And ultimately, that's the upside here.
Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre was a big supporter of Canada using cryptocurrency. Does that look kind of flawed now?
I think the people that know the least and think the least and spout the most are the biggest people that advocate on behalf of things like that. In times of Ponzi schemes, in times of opacity and mistruths and half-truths and hidden things, it's easy for people that know very little or that have, you know, no actual wisdom in the matter to look like they're geniuses, right? So they can talk about risky things, and if the risky things go up and look like they're making money, people think that they're a genius. And it's that, you know, classic adage about tides going out and naked people. You know, ultimately, it was just free money that was boosting all these bubbles and making people look like they knew what they were talking about. And as the discipline of a yield curve comes back into play here, as a good old-fashioned recession unfolds, something we have not seen since 2008, I think this is much more like a 2000 to 2002-3 environment where you have this very extended downturn that continues and grinds people finally back into submission in terms of animal spirits. And ultimately, that is, you know, much needed, healthy, regular part of the financial cycle that's been really just obliterated or truncated, stopped for the past several years by all these financial gimmicks. So yes, I think, you know, people that were espousing that kind of thing as a primary tool for transmission of monetary policy or whatever they were talking about were just blowing steam.
Danielle, it said it's easy to make money in good times, but the secret to wealth is keeping your money in bad. Is that so true?
Well, truthfully, the secret of money is to not waste it, to not blow it up, to be disciplined with what you spend and how you save, and to keep it up for many years. And that will always, I think, be the secret of money. And regardless of these mania phases that come and go, you know, there's that old saying, fools and their money are soon parted, and ultimately that is very true. So the good news is that you don't have to lose your mind. You can be intelligent, disciplined. You do have to seek out people that have a fiduciary duty to tell you what's in your best interest without selling you things. And those, unfortunately, are few and far between, and that makes it challenging for people to get the right advice.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you.
My guest has been Danielle Park. Check out her websites, jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. If you have any questions for Danielle or any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.